Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Football Friday continuing on Grant and Danny, presented by the Sportsbook at Hollywood Casino Charlestown. Every game and every bet for real sports fans. Happy to go to the Mattress Warehouse hotline right now and welcome in Radio.com Sports NFL Insider Channing Crowder. As always, Insider calls are brought to you by Indeed. Post a job today at Indeed.com/hire. Channing, thanks so much for joining us. The Dolphins have spent most of the year double-digit point underdogs, but now they've got an 0-5 Redskins team barely favored to beat them. What is the temperature and the tone for the Dolphins going into this matchup with struggling Washington?
It's weird down here, guys. Hey, how y'all doing, man? Thanks for having me. It's weird down here because I think a lot of the fan base has embraced the tank. We have people talking about Tua. We have people tweeting out Tua memes when he makes plays on Saturday. And they're even worried about Sunday, you know, more or less. And the team was prepared like this. You know, the team was really going into it with this approach, getting rid of Laramie Tunsil, getting rid of Minkah Fitzpatrick, who are both first-round draft picks for the Dolphins and now starting for other teams. So when you saw the approach, it is a weird game, but the teams combined are 0-9. But, I've been down here since 05. I got drafted, played for 6 years, been covering the Dolphins ever since, 15 years in, and this is a very peculiar situation we're in with this flat-out tank. But, yeah, it's a funny game to be favored in, because I'm betting against the Dolphins. I gamble. Now we can talk about gambling, guys. It's opening
right
up. So. Yeah. The nation's opening up. So I gamble, and I'm taking the Dolphins. I mean, I'm taking the Redskins in this one. Because, yeah, the Redskins are losing. Look at it. The Patriots beat the hell out of y'all. But, you know, 5-point losses, you know, 14-point losses. The Dolphins lost by 50 and 43 to start the season. Like, if we're as bad as y'all teams think y'all are, the Dolphins are even worse. It's that old saying, if you get in a room and take everybody's problems and throw them in a bucket, you'll probably pick your same problems out of that bucket. I think if you and the Dolphins, if the Redskins and the Dolphins had the problems compared, the Redskins will take their problems right back.
Well, Channing, with all due respect, you're underestimating how terrible the Redskins are, sir. You've got to update your file a little bit, because it's not just regular bad, which they are. It's the toxicity. It's the how much of a cluster the front office is. They've already fired their coach. The Dolphins are doing this by design. They're acquiring assets. The Redskins are sitting on an asset in a staring contest with Trent Williams, and they won't trade him. You guys moved on from Laramie Tunsil for a million picks. That should have been the Redskins' deal. So to me, the Dolphins are doing this on purpose. The Redskins aren't. It makes it that much worse to me.
Oh, yeah. And I'm with you on that one, too, where, you know, the front office of the Dolphins is stronger because they're in unison. Like, Brian Flores, Trent O'Shea, who's the offensive coordinator, Patrick Graham, who's the coordinator. Every time they come up, they just say the same thing. We're trying to pass the team to win. Oh, you know, we're trying to move forward. Oh, we're trying to give a good performance on the field. But the Redskins front office, and Dan Snyder, I just think about back when they were bringing in Bruce Smith and who was it, Daryl Green and guys like that, when they were just wanted a name. And, you know, Dan Snyder's been doing this for years where he messes up these the salary cap and the rosters. But I just see when y'all's corners, when Norman and Dunbar line up against our receivers, they're lining up against guys that wouldn't start for another team. Like, y'all's front, you talk about Kerrigan and Bostic and you just look at the players, some of the names that they're actually NFL players. Fellas, when you watch this game, you're going to hear names in the Dolphins secondary and names in the Dolphins front line that you've never heard of and will probably never hear about again. I see what you're saying, where I think we have the edge in the front office and the approach, but on the field, man, the talent on this Dolphins team is really struggling. Sooner or later, there's going to be a snap on the field. They're going to have to line up and the ref's going to blow the whistle. And I would tell you, the Redskins are more talented than the Dolphins, even with Donald King out there at left tackle without a Trent Williams. You know, Sheriff was a high pick. Eric Flowers is a UM guy. He was a first-round pick. Like, y'all actually tried to build a team, and it didn't work.
We didn't even try to build a team, fellas. We were trying not to build a team, which is the craziest part.
Yeah, you're right, and it's worked very well, as they have not yet won, and they're headed potentially to 0-5. Channing Crowder is on Grant and Danny on 106.7 The Fan. Channing, what's the deal with Josh Rosen? Does he have any chance of being the future in Miami? How has he played so far? It seems like the assumption is they're just going to get to a Tagovailoa, and he is going to maybe be on a third team in 3 years next year.
Yeah, Josh Rosen, he's decent. You know, I like to go out of UCLA. The Dolphins had a chance to jump up and get him. When Arizona jumped to 10, Dolphins were 11. So they could have jumped him and got him. They actually didn't assess him as a top 10 quarterback at the time. And then they go out there, they trade pick for the Saints, they bring him in for a second rounder. Now, after the fact, in hindsight, everything's 40-40. I didn't even know if they should have done that. He's out playing Ryan Fitzpatrick. Ryan Fitzpatrick came out and upset me. I thought Ryan Fitzpatrick would come out with the Fitzmagic. When I saw Tampa, over 1,000 yards in 3 games last year at Tampa. Ryan Fitzpatrick came out and was throwing 100 checkdowns a game. So at least Rosen's getting out there. Rosen's trying to make a name for himself, trying to get some respect back in this league, because it has to be an ego knock when a team that drafted 10 gets rid of you the following year for the next girlfriend that they just found, with the number one pick in Kyler Murray. So Rosen, decent. How I look at Rosen and what I really believe is going to happen, Arizona paid $10 million of his contract, signing bonus. The Dolphins owning $6 million for this year and the following 2 years. He's going to be a backup, and I think he could be a pretty good backup. I think he could come in. He'll be a great scouting guy. He's a smart kid. He's not going to cause any trouble. But to think that Josh Rosen at any point in his career, not just this year, next year, fellas, to think that Josh Rosen at any point in his career could lead a playoff team is crazy. He's going to be a decent backup. He looked good in college, but you know how that happens. You can go through the myriad of quarterbacks that looked good at the collegiate level and moved up. Rose is going to be a good backup for the rest of his career. I actually hope they keep him. They bring in Tua. They keep him as a backup. And, let Tua develop and have a safer backup behind him. But I think that's Rose's ceiling. It's being one of the top 10 backups in the league, something along that line.
Longtime Dolphins linebacker Channing Crowder with us here on Grant and Danny. Channing, is there any pieces actually worth building around down there? I've kind of from far away kind of coveted guys like Devontae Parker and Preston Williams. I liked Gesicki out of college, the tight end. Are there any pieces that will be here in the future that are worth building around?
Bro, if you want Devontae Parker, whatever you want, I'll give you. Take him off of our hands. I was excited about him too. He kept raising this and all. He's injured every other week. He dropped a lot of balls. Dallas game, he dropped the ball. A beautifully thrown, actually by Rosen, beautifully thrown ball on the 3-yard line. Would have been a touchdown. Flat out just dropped it. Devontae's so inconsistent. Gesicki is soft as cotton. He's a volleyball player. He's not made for this grown man game. I think Kenyon Drake will contribute to another team. Xavier Howard is the top corner. He got eaten up by Amari Cooper in the Dallas game. But other than that one game, for the last 2 years, actually last year he led the NFL in interceptions. So Xavier can play. Jerome Baker, you hear his name a lot. Jerome is a linebacker. He runs well. He can play. He's one of them glorified safety guys, a thief at linebacker position. Even the young guy, Christian Wilkins, he's okay, but he gets displaced a lot. There's not a lot of guys. I would say, here's the question, big picture. If the Dolphins folded and the entire roster was spread around the NFL, there might be 5 guys on the entire roster that would get burned with other teams.
Wow.
Rashad Jones being healthy, he can still play ball. But the entire offensive line, fellas, like this guy, this Shaq Calhoun, you've never heard that name? I know you haven't. Like, there's guys on this line that should not be playing at the NFL level. The Dolphins are giving them a chance because of the approach to the season. So, yeah, we have a handful of guys that would be foundational pieces moving forward. But there's no guy that I would say he's untradeable. I'll tell you that. If somebody offers a high first, second round pick for anybody on this roster, maybe other than Xavier Howard, I think Dolphins would jump on it.
Wow. I've never been more confident going into a game after scouting the opponent with somebody in a visiting market, Channing. Thank you for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
way, bro. It's weird for me to talk about it this way, but you know, you have your fandom and you have your analysis, and I got to analyze this thing for you guys. I don't like talking about it like this, but I got to be honest, man. I appreciate y'all having me.
Appreciate you, and that's what we want, is the honesty, and he brought it. Radio.com Sports NFL Insider Channing Crowder. Insider calls brought to you by Indeed. Post a job today at Indeed.com/hire. Big thanks to Channing for some insight. Grant and Danny on the fan. And what do you make of Adrian Peterson saying this was the best week of practice the Redskins have had since he's been here? We'll get into that next. 40 miles west of Washington, D.C. is a hidden gem and a well-kept secret. Fauquier County. Go out I-66 and find one of the 25 wineries or the half dozen breweries and spend a day outside of the rat race like I like to do, getting some fresh air. At night, you can actually see the stars. Beautiful countryside. There's a wine app available in Fauquier as well to download for those of you that like doing the winery thing. The breweries, the sixth one is coming. All many varieties of beer to try, casual fun for everyone. They've got great events this fall, including orchard and apple picking, pumpkin picking. Go to visitfauquier.com for information on some of the cool things you can do. That's visitfauquier.com. Yesterday, while talking with reporters, Adrian Peterson said this week was the best week of practice the Redskins have had since he showed up in Washington. Do you think he means it, Danny, or do you think he's just trying to give a burn to Jay Gruden on his way out the door, who he didn't get along with all that well?
I do believe, my friend Grant Paulson, that it's both of those things. I actually do think it was probably the best week of practice that he's had, because he was not one of Jay's guys. Jay had a group of guys. He was outside that group. He didn't get the text message. Didn't get the invite for Taco Tuesday. Had that awkward conversation outside the lavatory. He does not like Jay Gruden. I understand that. I get that, right? You want the ball. You come to a place like this, and you want to be featured. Your Hall of Fame career, you're putting a stamp on it. They had no interest in that. And Jay Gruden, most specifically, knew that his offense was just less dynamic with Adrian Peterson there. You have a lower ceiling, maybe a higher floor, honestly, in terms of a run game, but you can't do a lot of the exotic and fun and good matchup things that you can do with a more dynamic running back. So Adrian Peterson doesn't like Jay Gruden. I also think that Bill Callahan's going to do some old-school Callahan football, pad on pad, hat on hat, and that's all well and good. So they'll have a crisp week of practice. How sustainable is that? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I know that it's not Joe Gibbs' era when he could keep 95 bodies and you know, have full run-throughs doing the Oklahoma drill into January. You can't do that anymore. You got to keep these guys healthy because of the impacts and the schedule. So we'll see. I mean, it's one of those short-term burn things where you get to do it and get to say how intense you were. Maybe you win a game, but are you still doing that in 5 weeks? I don't know.
Yeah, I really like the way that they went back to some of the basics this week. I think that when you fire a coach, it lights a fire under everybody's butt. And I remember just talking to a couple people in the building after Jay Gruden got fired. They said, we should get a little dead cat bounce here.
Yeah.
Because it just stands to reason that everybody for the next couple of weeks is going to be minding their P's and Q's and really focused on themselves. And they know that there's some new eyeballs on them and the pressure is now heightened. So you're seeing what I call kind of the honeymoon phase for Bill Callahan, which is you implement a bunch of changes. And because what was happening before you got there wasn't working, everyone's going to sing your praises. We've heard this story a million times. It has been written as much as the off-season story about the player coming back to training camp in the best shape of his life, right? But yeah. I do like that we're going to run sprints to condition. I don't think this team's practice habits over the last couple of years were among the best in the NFL. I think you saw that when they were on the same practice field as New England. And those of us who had seen the way the Redskins practiced and the way the Patriots did said, wow, this is really different. So I have no problem with Callahan implementing some changes. I like having the officials at practice. Some of it seems almost eye-rollingly over the top or for the optics. But try something. Throw it against the wall. See what happens. As far as Peterson goes, I'm with you. I think he probably likes the structure a little bit more. I'll bet it looks more like what he's used to in previous stops. But I also think it was just an easy chance to get a dig at Gruden off.
Yeah.
Because those guys, they've been butting heads all season. If it was up to Jay Gruden, they would have cut Adrian Peterson. He wouldn't have been here. If it was up to Jay Gruden, I really don't think they would have re-signed him. You know, you saw the story that came out via ESPN.com within the last couple of days about Zach Brown and the fact that Jay Gruden and his staff didn't want to re-sign Zach Brown at all. They didn't think he was a fit. And the front office decided that he needed to be re-signed, so they gave him 3 years and $24 million. And he was benched within a couple of months. And you and I talked last year about what a difference that was and how they use him and what they paid him. Well, that's it was right. A clear indication of the front office and the coach not being on the same page. And Gruden has been talking over the last few days about the number of times where what he thought, what he said, maybe wasn't taken into account. That's going to happen for all first-time head coaches, I'd say. But it certainly happened with Peterson. And I would take some of what he says about Gruden, and I think you have to learn from it and file it into the important column, because as we've talked about, just because you got a divorce from someone doesn't mean you can't give a character witness analysis. However, I think some of it could also just be, I didn't like that guy very much. I like this guy better.
Yeah, and again, the style. You know what Callahan wants to do. He's an offensive line guy. That's where he comes from. So where's the emphasis going to be on making the offensive lineman happy and by transitivity, making running backs happy? He wants to ruin the dang ball, and that's all well and good.
You saw Callahan's comments about the run game this week, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to read them. I saved them, and we haven't gotten into it, but I actually just pulled them up. If you don't mind, I want to read this quote.
Please.
On running the ball more, I think running the football is about rushing attempts. One of the goals of our program when we were in New York with Rex Ryan, we were running the ball pretty well there. We had good success running the football. We had a really good offensive line, running backs. We had an outstanding unit of players and talent and scheming, and it was great. What I learned from Rex Ryan was it wasn't about what you average per carry effectiveness. It was really about rush attempts and pass completions. So that's one of the league statistics that we all look at is rush attempts a lot of times. Your rush attempts and completions. If you have more rush attempts than an opponent, really you're in good shape to win the football game. It's a very high percentage. I think it's over 80%. So it's about rush attempts and it's about pass completions. It's not about being perfect. It's not always right. It's just an identity that I believe in. So if we can combine those two and create big plays off of it, I think we'll be successful. He references that you win about 80% of the games when you run the ball more than your opponent without acknowledging that the reason you ran the ball more than your opponent is because you were leading the game. This is stuff that we explain to callers. I cannot believe he said that.
I can. I mean, I'm looking forward to Back to the Future coming out in theaters in this wonderful year 1985. It's outdated. It's archaic. But here's the thing. This is a low-ceiling team, and that raises your floor. You can be in games that you don't get beat as bad. If
you might get to 5-11 doing it that way.
Yeah, which, again, nobody should have any interest in that. The caller that doesn't call on our show as much anymore, but we'll sit there and go, how do you win the NFC East? You're running the ball, said the guy in the 1980s, because that's what we did then. The league has evolved. Get on board with this. Now, there are great defensive teams that counter what the league is doing in terms of passing efficiency. Just look at some of the teams that are up at the top of the league right now, like the Patriots, for example, taking away. They gave up their first touchdown pass last night to the New York Giants and Daniel Jones and company. But the league is about throwing the football effectively. And the different ways to do that are spread people out, throw it a bunch, use play action regardless of run play effectiveness, by the way. We've got enough data to prove that as well. So the old axiom of you got to establish the run, then you can use your play action game, we now know is patently untrue. That is untrue. All you need is simply any action to freeze the linebackers and more space is created. That's all this is to get people on their heels, to get people flat-footed, and that extra step, because guys are so quick, route combinations are so precise and so advanced, guys will get open. That's the leak. So yelling about rush attempts is adorable, it's precious, it's kindergarten-style thinking, but I understand trying to establish an identity of physicality and toughness when you're not good at the other way. If they were good at the other way, believe me, they'd be throwing the football.
Well, and you also can't succeed the other way. You don't have a quarterback that's going to win you games. You don't have weapons in the passing game with Reed and Vernon Davis concussed. You have Terry McLaurin and a cloud of dust. So, yeah, I got no problem trying it this way, particularly this week, for the record, when you should be able to run the ball on the Dolphins. It should work this week. Do it what works. Now, my issue is going to be that there's going to be a week in the coming weeks where you should throw the ball a lot against a defense with bad secondary play, and you're going to try to run it 40 times against a really good front, because if you run it more times than your opponent, you win 80% of the time. But we'll worry about that, I suppose, in the coming weeks. It may not matter what you do against Miami. It's probably going to work. They are that bad. We're Grant and Danny. You're listening to The Fan. At noon today, your Beltway Blitz. At 1 o'clock, Jim Duquette, a former general manager in Major League Baseball, on the NLCS, which starts tonight, the Nats and the Cardinals. Let's get back into the league championship series in just a few moments right here on G&D. NLCS Game 1 tonight. The Nationals and the Cardinals. First pitch scheduled for the 8 o'clock hour back home. It is raining in St. Louis off and on today. It's actually really nasty. I'm sitting right now downtown in St. Louis, and I mean, there's no clouds or blue skies because it's just one white sheet. It almost feels like you're flying in an airplane looking out the window, and there's like a white sheet hanging over the glass. You can't really see anything above you, and it's nasty. It's been wet. It's been cold. Miles Michaelis to start for the Cardinals. Anibal Sanchez for the Nats. First pitch at 8:08 East time back home, 7:08 local. I wonder if the weather will be a factor. I mean, look, Major League Baseball is going to call the shots, not the home team in the playoffs, obviously.
Right.
If you're going to have weather like they've had today, though, so far, I mean, it's just kind of gross, slow, methodical, off and on drizzling, so to speak. They'll play through that all night. So it's not going to be fun to sit in the crowd if you're the Cardinals fans and watch that. But they're not going to play because it's wet. You'd have to have driving storms, I would think, to not play a playoff game because they really want those built-in travel days.
It's going to have to be bad enough where it either starts bad and doesn't let up, or there's not going to be a window. They want this game to get in. That's where they come at this from the default, not necessarily, hey, what's best for the quality of play on the field? Their default is, we've scheduled this. This is the time. This is when the TV crews will be there. We'd rather get it in than not. So I'm with you. I'm betting that they do end up playing this game, even with some of the nasty weather. I was looking at some St. Louis local weather sites. It just sounds like it's going to be nasty. It's going to be miserable. You'd expect, and we've already seen this kind of throughout the playoffs, GP, the ball's not traveling the same way that it was. Conspiracy theorists, put your tinfoil hats on here. Is the ball different? Is it because the weather's colder? Who knows what the actual explanation is? But you'd expect the ball not really to fly tonight. And I wonder who you think that favors.
I would think that would probably favor the Cardinals a little bit. They steal bases like the Nationals do, and they put the ball in play. As I mentioned, they really only have three guys who hit over 20 home runs. The Nationals have a little bit more power than them. But I'm not sure it's a decided edge because the Nats also build offense and create runs and manufacture scoring chances when they're going right offensively with guys like Trey Turner, who might not jump out of the yard all the time but can turn a single into a double with a stolen base. Adam Eaton, working counts, drawing walks. In the bottom of the order specifically, whether it's Michael Taylor or Victor Robles, we've seen the Nationals time and time and time again this year get a couple on and all of a sudden have a big inning without hitting home runs. Now, they are much more prone, though, to waiting for the three-run homer than I think St. Louis has been. They really have three guys that give it to them. Now, what I'm interested in is the starters tonight and whether or not they get affected by this chilly weather. You got to go back to the first week or two of the season to find the last time you've pitched in legitimately cold weather. Now, the Cardinals in their series with Atlanta didn't have to deal with it. You and I were broadcasting from the field a round ago, and you're in khaki shorts chilling comfortably at Nationals Park.
That's
why?
Right.
Because it was sunny and it was lovely. I mean, it was warm. If anything, particularly for game one of the wild card play to start the postseason, it was really, really hot and gross. I couldn't even go for a walk around the ballpark. It was so humid. I just went and sat inside at a sports bar in the air conditioning. So it's a completely different situation. And I think you now know why a bunch of the Nationals have been under the weather, right? I
mean, yeah, it's not easy. Not an easy.
This is a bad time of the year.
Cold. Yeah, and that's why bugs go around. You're absolutely right. I mean, you and I are not playing in division championship series, a league championship series, and we're both fighting it simply because the temperature outside changed, just like billions of people worldwide. So,
what do you think, batter versus pitcher, though, in cold weather where you know, cold enough like tonight where you might see the breath of the pitcher, who's that benefit, offense or pitching?
Well, if it's too cold to grip the ball effectively, but a little bit of moisture in the air is actually good for that. Not a lot. If it's too humid, then you're too sweaty. It's actually harder to grip the ball. And you'll see guys going to the rosin bag or, you know, wiping their hands off, or you blowing your fingers a little bit. But if it's just kind of cold and miserable or chilly and miserable, big time advantage for pitching. Big, big, big time advantage.
Yeah, because you're just standing there waiting on them, and they are going through the motion 17, 18 times maybe in an inning. And for 100-plus pitches, they can also go back and sit in the clubhouse and wear their jacket and stay warm by a space heater or something. There's no DH in the National League. So, yes, you are in the field, obviously. But for the most part, you're standing in the on-deck circle. You're trying to do arm circles or something to stay loose. You're walking up to the box, and now you're being sawed off with 91 in on your hands on a cold night. I looked up the numbers.
It doesn't feel good, man. It doesn't feel good at all when it's cold out, for sure.
Miles Michaelis against the Nats this year. He pitched on May 1st against them. That was at Nats Park. So many of you guys may have been at that game. He went six innings and allowed one run, only walked one with just four strikeouts, allowed seven hits. They had him a couple times, if you remember that start, on the ropes, and for whatever reason, they just couldn't break through. They stranded some runs. And then they also saw him really well recently. On September 17th, eight hits to go along with a walk and hit batsman. So 10 base runners in six innings. They only scored three runs. Again, he was able to wiggle out of a couple of jams against the Nationals. But this is a guy who had a 272 average against in a lot of his outings this season when you look up the numbers. So he's going to be in the strike zone. His stuff is not plus-plus. He's not a high-volume strikeout guy. He's mostly going to go around six innings, give you between three and six strikeouts. Kind of an Anibal Sanchez-like
starter,
frankly.
I was going to say, a lot of mirror, yeah. The stuff isn't otherworldly, just an effective guy that's actually out there pitching, right? There's no, I'll just throw 100 right here. He doesn't have that in the bag.
He's not anything. Walker Buehler.
Right, he's definitely not that. But these guys can be effective, too. He's not in the big leagues by accident. Didn't just sort of luck his way into a roster spot, and they say, oh, well, we'll just see what we can do here. No, this guy's good enough to certainly pitch effectively. He's got to be more precise, I would certainly say. And he's someone that's going to attempt to play on your anxiousness. He'll attempt to play on your attempts to do too much, just like Sanchez. I mean, think about the out pitch for Anibal Sanchez in that game against the Dodgers when he was so effective. He's throwing that Bugs Bunny changeup, right? That low 70s. I'm not talking about high 70s. That low 70s changeup where guys are just waving at it because it looks like a beach ball and you feel like you can kill it and it just sort of dies like a wounded quail on its way to home plate. Michaelis isn't quite going to do that, certainly, but he's going to play on your desire to do more, maybe, than you probably should.
He's Danny. I'm Grant. You're listening to The Fan, or as we've been calling it over the last couple weeks, 106.7 The Nats. Anibal Sanchez has pitched once this postseason. He is very fresh, and he is coming off of a tremendous outing against the Dodgers. The Cardinals have been, in the postseason, a team that grinds at bats and kind of gets starting pitchers out of the game earlier than not over their last several iterations. I love the fact that this matchup, though, in the NLCS for the right to get to the World Series is against the team that started the entire narrative for the Nationals in 2012, Danny, of playoff failures. Remember, it was Game 5, up huge, six runs early in that game, and then Drew Storen on the hill with several pitches to end the division series. The Cardinals eliminate the Nationals, or else in their first ever playoff berth, they would have been on to the NLCS, and who knows what happens for that 98-win team after that. Instead, though, they lose what would be the next three Game 5 division series at home in excruciating fashion, 0-4 before finally breaking through. So, like the Capitals, when they beat the Penguins, another chance to, on your way maybe to a World Series run, exercise a demon that has lived in the back of your mind for a long, long time.
The only a few members of the organization, guys like Ryan Zimmerman, were there for that and obviously participated in that series. So it's
Suzuki's
not the same.
Back.
Yeah, Suzuki, once again, kind of recycled through the league. But, yes, he is back. You're right. Good point about that. I forgot there. But, you know, Strasburg was on the team, of course, was shut down famously. You're right. It would be some nice symmetry if we're able to do that and ultimately head to a World Series. Even though, again, most of the personnel, Jason Mott closed that game out. He's not there. Trevor Rosenthal was a Nat this year. He was in that game. And you know, you look at some of the other pieces that were instrumental. Carlos Beltran had a huge hit in the ninth inning. There's no Descalso, no Cosma. But you're right. Going through St. Louis, organization with plenty of playoff pedigree would be pretty amazing for the Nationals this year.
Yeah, the teams, nothing like they were then. The series have nothing to do with one another other than just for fans, I think, it would feel good to reverse the fortunes of now, believe it or not, 7 years ago. The Red October on The Fan is presented by PVI Office Furniture. Fast, excellent, affordable. Business grows with PVI. Visit their showroom in Frederick, Maryland, or online at PVIPVI.com today. What are your thoughts on Game 1? How you feeling about tonight? We'll get to your calls next. 800-636-1067 is the number on Grant and Danny. Football Friday, presented as always by the Sportsbook at Hollywood Casino Charlestown. Every game, every bet for real sports fans. We'll be ranking some of the best NFL games of Sunday next hour, as we always like to do on Fridays here on Grant and Danny. I'll say this, the slate this weekend is outstanding. Not to give away the rankings, but just a few games that jumped out at me looking during the break, Danny. Eagles-Vikings, super important. One of those teams will be 500 through six games and really disappointed in itself. The other will be 4-2 and in good shape to potentially make the playoffs. You've also got an intriguing matchup in Cleveland where the Browns are trying to stay afloat at 500. Seattle looks like one of the best teams in the league all of a sudden at 4-1. I love that 49ers-Rams game.
I
think
too.
The projected game score, like the quality of game, is the highest of any game so far this season. The Rams have dropped two straight. I mean, they can't be 3-3 through six coming off a Super Bowl without being disappointed. But if San Francisco beats them, think about what people will be saying around the country about the Niners with consecutive wins over the Browns and over the Rams on the road at 5-0. They'd be the truth, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the Rams lost two games in 4 days. Think about it. Playing Sunday, turn around to Thursday, they're 3-0 on top of the world. Now they're 3-2 and scrambling, and they got to catch San Francisco, who's gotten off to an unbelievable start. The reason San Francisco is playing well, obviously the running game in San Francisco is outstanding. I mean, they are. It doesn't matter who's carrying the football. They're running really, really well. It was Tevin Coleman. It was Matt Breida last week. But defensively, San Francisco has been outstanding. Better than I thought they'd be, to be quite frank. And part of that's playing some bad opponents, but they're getting after you. They've got great team speed, especially on defense. Another game you didn't mention, though, Jeeps. Think about this. Jacksonville, New Orleans. I'm kidding. That's a joke. Kansas City and Houston is a great game as well. Kansas City, a juggernaut at this point, right? They've survived a couple games, and Houston has looked really, really good, put up a million points last week, I believe, against those Jaguars. Both teams class acts in the AFC. That's another marquee matchup there with Kansas City on the road in Houston.
Yeah, I think that tells you more probably about the Texans than the Chiefs, not unlike this 49ers-Rams game is in some way a referendum on San Francisco. But you know what I'd throw into that same category? Lions-Packers is Monday night this weekend.
Yeah.
You got Aaron Rodgers, Matt
that's
Stafford.
That's not a bad game at all.
No, NFC North. So if Detroit wins that game, they're 3-1-1, and they have basically the identical record where the Packers are right now despite the bye. If not for that week one tie against Arizona, which could come back to haunt them. But they've lost one game outright this season. I happen to believe the Packers are one of the best three or four teams in football right now. Their defense is better, and Aaron Rodgers is their quarterback. I don't really have many more questions than that. If they can pick up two or three tough yards on the ground when they need to, they could be a portable playoff-caliber team with Matt LaFleur in his first season as a very balanced play caller. But Green Bay's 4-1 with a really tough loss to an Eagles team that was desperate. They could be 5-0. So I think if they get to 5-1, they start to get their credit at the top of some of these power rankings in the NFC. But more importantly, what if the Lions win? They coming into the year were expected to be a 5-11, 6-10 team. Matt Patricia's got them playing every game very close. And after a debacle of a week one collapse, they've responded beautifully. They're 3-1 since if they beat the Packers.
You could have all four teams in that division over 500 potentially this weekend. That might be the best division
in football.
It might be top to bottom. I don't know that you have a juggernaut there. I mean, even though we both think Green Bay is good, I can't get that the Philadelphia Eagles loss out of my head where they just ran so effectively. But you're wondering if maybe that was a correctable thing that Philadelphia found for 1 week. But defensively, Green Bay has gotten into the modern NFL. They finally spent on players. That side of the ball is now pretty damn good, I think, at a minimum. So you start to look at that and say, yeah, we'll keep Aaron Rodgers upright. We've still got a passing game that revolves around one of the great quarterbacks of all time, but a commitment to sort of take some of the hits away from Rodgers and give the ball to Aaron Jones and company. Green Bay, I think, is the truth. This is a big one for Detroit, though. I think you're right about that. You had Detroit as kind of one of those teams that was going to be sneaky, going to be pretty decent. I thought they'd be a laughingstock once again because I thought Patricia was the clown shoe, but here they are. They are in a pretty good spot. They took Kansas City to the mat. Probably should have won that game, to be honest with you. So they've been impressive here through a handful of weeks.
Within the division, the Giants lost last night on Thursday Night Football to the Patriots in a game that saw Julian Edelman catch double-digit passes for 100 yards. The Patriots' offense still just, and maybe they're devoid of weapons to be lethal, but they're very average. They're great on defense, and they're exceptional on special teams. And they scored two non-offensive touchdowns again last night. They won by 21. They picked off rookie Daniel Jones three times. It was playing without Saquon Barkley, without Evan Ingram, without Sterling Shepard, among others offensively. It was just on paper, going to be an ugly game, and it played out that way.
Yeah,
New England covered a 17.5-point spread and won by 21. But then elsewhere in the division, so we mentioned Eagles, Vikings, 1 o'clock kickoff in Minneapolis on Sunday. You've got the Cowboys and the Jets. Dallas is going to get to 4-2, and we still don't really know how good they are because they won 3 games against bad teams or teams they should beat. Then they lost 2 games when their competition stepped up a level. And now you get the Jets, who are 0-4, and probably outside of the Dolphins and the Redskins, maybe the 3rd worst team in the league so far.
Yeah, them and the Bengals are in that conversation. They're all vying for it. This is the toilet bowl week, but you're right. Dallas will win this game because the Jets are not competent. I don't know what Sam Darnold's status is, even if he is playing. Can't imagine how much he'll help here this week. Le'Veon Bell will get some looks, but so what? You know, it'd be nice fantasy today, I'm sure, but it's not going to help them win anything. The Jets are a disaster. But back to Dallas specifically, they beat up, did what you should do against teams that are bad, and they look good doing it. Throttled the Giants in week 1, handily beat the Redskins in week 2 by 10 points, beat the Dolphins 31-6, even though that was a close game in the first half, by the way, before they ultimately pulled away. Offensively, though, they came crashing back down to earth. They scored 30-plus points in all 3 of their first 3 games, only managed 10 on the road in New Orleans, kind of a coming-out party for New Orleans' defense, playing their 2.0 style without Drew Brees back there, let Teddy Bridgewater hand it off and check it down. But only 10 points is a major disappointment, I think. And they tried to go stride for stride with Green Bay and couldn't do that in a home game where you thought they would rebound. So this is a big one in the sense that they need to start harvesting their nuts. They're going to compete with Philadelphia for that division.
Did you watch, by the way, last night? I know there was a lot going on, and you were plugged
in
on the Mystics game as well as what was going on with the Patriots and the Giants. Did you see any of Gerrit Cole against the Rays?
That was so. I had the two things I was watching last night were the obviously the Patriots and Giants, and Gerrit Cole just masterful. Gave up an early hit, and that was it. Just mowing people down, and that's their quote unquote second best starter there in Houston. Their staff is absurd.
It's ridiculous. I honestly don't know how they'll lose a series. I'm amazed that the Rays took them 5 games and won back to back over Greinke and Verlander. That's an unbelievable accomplishment for Tampa Bay. But Cole tossed 8 innings, 1 run, 2 hits, and he struck out 10. I only bring it up for 2 reasons. One, he struck out 10 or more batters in 11 consecutive starts, which is a Major League Baseball record. We've never seen anything like what he's doing right now. But I saw this nugget earlier today, and I just wanted to bounce it off you. In his playoff starts in Houston since coming to the Astros, he has struck out 40% of the batters he's faced. Think about that.
In postseason games?
Yes. So if he's faced 100 batters, he's retired 40 via the strikeout. I mean, it's just...
Goodness gracious. We've
never seen anything like this. He'll be on the hill soon enough in an ALCS that is going to have the country's attention. Nobody really thought, expected, maybe even wanted Nationals, Cardinals, although we really did here in D.C.
Yeah, it was exciting for us. We're all in. That's
right. This Yankees-Astros series is the two best teams in the league all season long, and it's what everyone's been counting down to really since
that's gonna be fun.
April. The Beltway Blitz is next on Grant and Danny here on The Fan. We'll cover the teams in town you care the most about. In the 12 o'clock hour, we will get you set for the first pitch of tonight's Nats-Cardinals game. Remember, Jim Duquette on the show in a little over an hour from now, a former Major League Baseball general manager, to make his pick on who's going to win the NLCS. You're listening to 106.7 The Nats.
The Washington Nationals have won their first postseason series in franchise history in the most thrilling fashion. Louisville Slugger's been making bats since 1884, and BigTimeBats.com is releasing this Nationals postseason commemorative bat. The full-size bat has the reproduced artwork, and famed sports artist Jolene Jesse is limited to 5,000 individually numbered bats and sells for $129.95 plus shipping and handling. The stunning all-white bat has the Nationals logo and the artwork of Jolene Jesse featuring the historic D.C. landscape with Old Glory standing tall behind the landscape. The bat also has key stats from that series against the Dodgers and the scores of the triumphant series. Go to BigTimeBats.com now to order or call 866-280-BATS. That's 866-280-BATS for the historic Nationals' first playoff series win. Trademarks and logos used with permission.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.